In just a moment, Generations with Kevin Swanson. But first, this. The World View in 5 minutes.
It's Wednesday, July 15th, 2015 AD. This is The World View in 5 minutes. I'm Adam McManus. Nearly everyone is calling the nuclear deal with Iran historic. Some are calling it a hopeful new chapter and an answer to prayer, while others are decrying it as a tragedy and further evidence America is on a path to destruction. Many are concerned the $150 billion windfall Iran will get as soon as sanctions are lifted will be used to fund terrorism against the U.S. That's $470 for every man, woman, and child in the U.S. Iran is hands down the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. Congress could vote to not ratify the agreement, but Obama has already said he would veto any such vote. A bipartisan two-thirds majority vote in the House would be needed to override the veto. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, "The world is a more dangerous place today than it was yesterday," calling the deal an historic mistake for the world.
Our concern, of course, is that the militant Islamic State of Iran is going to receive a sure path to nuclear weapons. Many of the restrictions that were supposed to prevent it from getting there will be lifted. And in addition, Iran will get a jackpot of cash bonanza of hundreds of billions of dollars, which will enable it to continue to pursue its aggression and terror in the region and in the world. This is a bad mistake of historic proportions.
The bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Tennessee has announced his regional body will not perform homosexual marriages. The Right Reverend John Bauerschmidt released a statement stating that his diocese will not perform such unions. Bauerschmidt wrote, "In 2012, the General Convention authorized provisional rites for the blessings of same-sex relationships under the direction and with the permission of the local bishop. Under these provisions, I have not given direction or permission for the use of these rites." Unquote. In Romans 11:3-5, Paul recounts the story of how the prophet Elijah was discouraged and felt he was the only one left who served God, saying, "And what was God's answer to him? I have reserved for myself 7,000 who have not bowed their knee to Baal." Donald Trump is now at the head of the pack of GOP presidential hopefuls. According to the new USA Today poll, Trump has 17% of the vote, with Governor Jeb Bush trailing by 3%. The bigger news might be that Bush is the strongest candidate against Clinton. Bush trails Clinton by 4%, while Trump trails by 17%. Macy's customers are choosing to dump the department store and not Trump by the thousands. TMZ claimed Tuesday a reported 30,000 Macy's customers have complained, many of whom canceled their charge accounts with Macy's in support of the Donald. 2 weeks ago, Macy's cut ties with Trump over his views on illegal immigration. Dent County, Missouri commissioners voted Monday to observe a full year of mourning over the U.S. Supreme Court's nationwide legalization of homosexual marriages. They said the courthouse flag would be lowered to half-staff the 26th of each month for a year to show their sorrow. After getting national attention on Tuesday and feedback from upset veterans who thought using the flag lowering, usually reserved for military mourning, was a bad idea, they decided to rescind that order. The military may be the next to march in support of the tide of change sweeping the nation. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced Monday a plan to study, quote, readiness implications of welcoming transgendered persons to serve openly, unquote. A number of questions have already been raised. Should soldiers in combat zones be allowed to take massive hormone doses? At what point should new uniforms be issued during a sexual transition? And should their barracks change afterwards? If this weren't so sad, it would be funny. May God have mercy on us all. Deuteronomy 22:5 says, "A woman shall not wear men's clothing, nor shall a man wear women's clothing. For whosoever shall do these things is an abomination to the Lord your God." The Christian Post reported the shocking and stomach-turning findings of a three-year undercover study of Planned Parenthood Tuesday, featuring video of interviews from company executives The report claims that Planned Parenthood has been harvesting organs and body parts and selling them. Their findings were released first on the Center for Medical Progress website. One video of Planned Parenthood's senior medical director, Deborah Nakatola, shows her over lunch drinking wine, explaining how the way they do the abortions can be tailored to what body parts they want. Apparently, heart, liver, and lung tissue, if intact, is illegally being bought by pharmaceutical companies, universities, and even governmental agencies. Revelation 21:8 says, "All murderers shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone." And that's the worldview on this Wednesday, July 15th, in the year of our Lord, 2015. I'm Adam McManus. Seize the day for Jesus Christ.
Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio Broadcast. Today we're going to be talking about worldview and how to apply that, how to do apologetics, and how to root and ground ourselves, our families, our fellow brothers and sisters in the churches, in a proper way of thinking. We want to make sure that we have a solid biblical perspective, especially when we have all these other ideas, imaginations, and high things that exalt themselves above the knowledge of God in Christ. We've got quite a challenge, and in some senses, our challenge is more difficult than somebody who may be living in a cannibalistic pagan culture in the latter 19th century. If you are attending a college in the 21st century in the Western world, you better be equipped. You better understand the ideas and the imaginations that have captured the major institutions across this country. And so it behooves us to dig into these things. And today we're going to be taking a look at Nancy Piercy's latest book, Total Truth, or Finding Truth. She's got a couple other books out there, Total Truth, Saving Leonardo, and the latest, Finding Truth. Nancy is a professor at Houston Baptist University. She's written a number of very helpful books on apologetics and worldview, and she has also homeschooled her children as well. Nancy, welcome back to the Generations Broadcast. It's good to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
Yes, and your new book is Finding Truth, and in some sense, this may be the most important book you've ever written. It gets right down to the very nub of what our young people need to understand almost before they hit the college scene. But first, from a biographical perspective, Nancy, does this tie into your journey in any way?
Well, I'm glad you said that it's almost the most important because it does get to the heart of my own life. I gave up my Christian faith when I was in high school and embarked on a search for truth. I was at a secular high school and was surrounded by secular friends, and I simply started asking, how do we know Christianity is true? I just went to the heart.
Yeah.
I didn't ask for sort of insider questions. I went straight to the outside and looking in, how do I know that Christianity is true? And unfortunately, none of the adults in my life could answer that question. Apologetics just wasn't available back then. And when I didn't get answers to my questions, I decided, well, maybe Christianity doesn't have any answers. And I decided that I really thought of it as a matter of intellectual honesty. I thought if you don't have good reasons for something, you can't say you really believe it, whether it's Christianity or anything else. So I very consciously rejected my Christian upbringing and embarked on a search for truth. So I went through several years as an agnostic before I ended up at LaBrie, the ministry of Francis and Edith Schaeffer in Switzerland. And that was the first place I encountered Christians who were able to engage with the secular ideas that I had embraced by that time, and which was very impressive. I just had never met any Christians who could answer the isms of our day. And so that's why I have become so passionate myself about the importance of listening to young people, taking their questions seriously, because it was my own experience. And I would like to see parents and teachers and homeschooling parents in particular up their game in terms of being able to answer young people's questions and perhaps avoid having to go through all those years of agnosticism that I went through. Stay strong in your faith and, you know, go into college prepared for the various secular theories that you're going to encounter.
Apparently, the problem has spread into evangelical colleges. Your opening chapter begins, "I lost my faith at an evangelical college," where you talk about somebody you've met at a congressional hearing. And this guy said he lost his faith at an evangelical college. Well, what is wrong with the evangelical colleges? What are they missing?
Right. This was actually it was a launch event for one of my earlier books, For Total Truth. And so here I was talking about the importance of truth on Capitol Hill, the Capitol Hill staffers. And when I was done with my presentation, a chief of staff stood up and said to everyone in the room, "I lost my faith at an evangelical college." So, of course, I asked him what happened. And he was at a respected evangelical college. You would know it if I told you the name. And he said, "I asked questions of my teachers because they went to church on Sunday. But in the classroom, they simply taught from the secular textbooks." And he said, "I went to them in their office hours and said, but how do you relate the two? How do you connect your theological convictions to what you teach in the classroom?" And he said not one of them could give him an answer. There was a survey done of the CCCU school. This is a coalition of Christian colleges and universities. These are the evangelical schools. And it was done in 2007. And only half of the professors said they were confident that they could give a Christian perspective on the field that they teach. Only half. I mean, when we send our kids to Christian colleges, we're not thinking only half of the professors are going to be able to speak from a Christian worldview. So this is a problem that we're facing, especially as we're preparing our young people to go off to college. It's not just the secular schools. They need to be prepared with a Christian worldview, even if they're going to a Christian university.
Is the problem synthesis? Is the problem a weakness in faith? Is there a problem with this idea of a separation of our faith, what we get on Sunday, from applying it to the ideas that are out there? Is it overly trusting Darwin and Nietzsche and not thinking that there may be something wrong with their philosophical system?
Well, and to be charitable, most of the professors, even at Christian colleges, got their graduate degrees from secular institutions, secular graduate schools, where they did not have a realistic opportunity to really think through what is a Christian perspective on my field. In fact, they probably had to slide below the radar screen. They may have been penalized if they expressed a Christian perspective. And so they come to Christian colleges having not ever really had an opportunity to do that kind of integration. And you're right, as long as nobody's doing it, eventually we don't know how. You know, we're told we should have a Christian worldview, but most of us don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to my current book, Finding Truth. Finding Truth goes to Romans 1 and shows people basic steps that they can take to develop a Christian worldview and to critique secular worldviews in any field. It simplifies the process by showing basic scriptural principles at work, whether you're in psychology, economics, history, you know, whatever your discipline, you can apply these scriptural principles to critique secular worldviews and come up with a credible Christian alternative.
And the Apostle Paul was well equipped to that. He was raised in Tarsus, one of the philosophical centers, one of the three philosophical centers of the Roman Empire, and he understood the Jews. So he understood the Jews, and he understood the philosophy of the Greeks probably better than anybody. And he just, I think he lays it out beautifully, obviously in Acts 17 at Mars Hill, but then all the way through the book of Romans, we see the same thing. Why not copy the Apostle Paul and pull some of his techniques?
Exactly. And in Romans, he's writing to a congregation who had not heard him speak before. Maybe they weren't even all Christians. So he lays out the case for Christianity in a very comprehensive, methodological way. And he starts with what? He starts by saying, everyone has access to evidence for God, no matter where they live, when they live, you know, what their background. They all have access to this evidence. How? Through the created order. And most of the time we think of the beauty and complexity of nature. And that's important. I've written a lot about that. But in finding truth, I focus more on the evidence from human nature. In other words, you and I, human beings, are products of a part of the created order as well. And how do we give evidence for God? Well, because humans are capable of choosing, the first cause that created them must have a will. And because humans are capable of thinking, the first cause that created them must have a mind, and so on. As one Christian philosopher puts it, because a human is a someone and not a something, the source of human life must also be a someone and not the blind automatic forces of nature, like materialism or naturalism would tell us. Or as the psalmist says, does he who fashioned the ear not hear? Does he who formed the eye not see? So right from the beginning, Paul is suggesting a way of arguing for Christianity that doesn't depend on you being from any particular culture, having any particular background. This is knowledge that's intimately available to everyone because it's our own human nature.
And yet they suppress the truth and unrighteousness, so there's sort of this tension within the unbeliever. On the one hand, they know, and on the other hand, they don't know, or they deceive themselves. But we've got to be able to work with that.
Yeah, it's really amazing. When I was writing Finding Truth, what I discovered is that there are leading secular thinkers today who acknowledge that their own materialist, naturalist worldview doesn't fit the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And this gives us our in. We can show them that. Well, here's an example. The example that my students always remember the best. MIT professor named Rodney Brooks. He's professor emeritus now. He used to be head of the artificial intelligence lab. So we're talking about leading, prominent thinkers here. And he wrote a book in which he said, a human being is just a big bag of skin full of biomolecules interacting by the laws of physics and chemistry. Essentially, we're robots, biochemical machines. And then he says, I know it's hard to see people this way in practice, but if I try, I can see that my children are machines. In the next sentence, he says, is that how I treat them? Of course not. He says, they have my unconditional love.
Yeah.
And then he says, I realize that love has no rational analysis within my own materialist worldview, because obviously robots don't love. So it was a wonderful example of how, of what Paul was talking about in Romans 1. We have this intimate, irrepressible, undeniable knowledge of being personal beings made in the image of a personal God, where love and moral choice and so on are real. And that knowledge keeps breaking through, even for people whose professed worldview tells them that the machine's made in the image of matter. So there's that cognitive dissonance,
yeah,
where they recognize the truth of general revelation, and yet they're trying to suppress it. In this case, with a materialist worldview, they're trying to suppress it, but it keeps breaking through.
Yeah, they can't resolve the immaterial in the materialistic worldview. Then you have the rationalism-irrationalism game. Half the time, it seems the humanists are wanting to argue on empiricism and evidence and rationalism, then they surrender to irrationalism, nihilism, and romanticism. Do they ever admit to their tensions? Do they admit to their self-contradictions? That they're, you know, rationalistic the same at one moment, and then they're moving on to irrationalism, romanticism, you know, the next moment? It happens in the same classroom, happens in the same textbook, happens with the same philosopher. You take somebody like Nietzsche, you know, moving from a rationalism to irrationalism. Do they understand that there is this incredible contradiction within their own system, and are they willing to admit to it?
Well, you do, that's what's so amazing. And in the examples that I found and that I included in Finding Truth, is there's a growing admission that there's a problem. In fact, many people now say that the problem of consciousness has become central in philosophy. Before, it used to be the literary types and the theologians who said, you know, you can't get rid of free will, you can't get rid of love, you can't get rid of these personal dimensions. But now it's the scientists and philosophers themselves who are saying, wait a minute, we can't explain human beings. Here's another example from the book, just to give you another example. It's a guy named Edward Slingerland, who also says, I'm a materialist, I'm an evolutionist, there's no such thing as free will. And yet he says, we can't help thinking and acting as though we are free. In fact, here's a funny line. He says, we are robots designed not to believe that we're robots.
Yeah.
He goes further than that. He actually admits, this was amazing. He admits that the idea that we are just robots really is, here's his words. He says it's bizarre and repugnant. It inspires in us a kind of emotional resistance and revulsion. You see, he's acknowledging that not only is his worldview contrary to his own experience, but it inspires revulsion. He said, in fact, if you really went around thinking people were robots and biochemical machines, he said, we would call that kind of a person a psychopath.
Yeah, yeah. And it destroys morality. It destroys human responsibility and culpability. And we just couldn't function. The whole world would come apart.
That's right. In fact, I even quote one philosopher who says, we need to hush this up.
Yeah.
The elites need to know that we're just machines, because that's what science shows us, materialist science, of course. That's what materialism tells us. But the elites can know that, but they better not tell ordinary people, because it will destroy our sense of morality. It'll destroy our, you know, the social basis, the moral basis for society. It'll destroy people's sense of identity. I mean, this is way too harmful. We just can't tell anybody. So it's amazing how much even secular people are beginning to acknowledge exactly what you said, that reality doesn't fit. Human nature doesn't fit their worldview. And they're trying to come to grips with it, just like Romans says. You know, God presses them to the point. Remember in Romans it says God lets people follow out the implications of their own idols. Well, the idols today, many of them are isms. You know, they are the theoretical systems that people follow. And God is allowing these people to follow out the logic of their idol, their intellectual idol, until the tension is almost overbearing. As you see in these people, these examples, the tension between acknowledging that we're human and yet trying to follow out their worldview. Well, the question is, which one are they going to ultimately believe? Are they going to go with their human experience of being made in God's image, or are they going to cling to their worldview in the face of the evidence?
Our guest today, Nancy Percy, in the new book, Finding Truth. And Nancy, I'd like to get back to some of the examples you use in the book, which, by the way, is very helpful and makes this more pedestrian for people like me. You raise the example of a college kid named John, raised in a Baptist home. He gets off to college, begins to leave the faith, teams up with Nietzsche to go after the caricatures of the Christian church, poor replicas, straw men. Somehow the real message, the real truth, has been submerged in the incipient weaknesses of a failing church. So here's my question. How do young people today, how do Christian young people raised in the church get back to what the Bible really said, versus all of these false replicas, caricatures, et cetera, that have collected in the church or in his own mind and heart?
Yeah, let me start by saying occasionally I still run into people who say, well, they should just drop out of the intellectual world. In other words, Christians shouldn't bother answering their questions, because after all, our young people are postmodern these days and they don't think rationally. So, you know, they've essentially thrown in the towel. And over against that, I would point out, in Finding Truth, I quote studies that show that the main reason young people are leaving their faith today is because of intellectual questions.
Yeah.
The researchers themselves were surprised. They expected young people to talk about some kind of emotional wounding, relationship issues, because that's what we're told. Not so. The main reason young people themselves gave for leaving the faith was that they had unanswered doubts and questions. The largest and most respected study asked open-ended questions. So these were young people speaking in their own words, saying things like, it doesn't make sense to me, I have too many questions. And the researchers have concluded the main reason that young people deconvert is, quote, intellectual skepticism. So it's very important, I would say, that we treat young people's questions seriously and that we do the hard work of finding answers. One of the things we learned from Francis Schaeffer was you may have to reword and rephrase the Christian truths in order to answer the questions of a new generation. Intellectual change happens and cultural change happens so quickly today that often the younger generation thinks differently from their parents' generation. And so we have to think more in terms of being missionaries to our own kids and listening to the worldviews that they're expressing and that they're being exposed to. And sometimes, you know, those weren't your questions when you were young, but still you need to do the hard work of finding answers and rephrasing timeless truths in the language that generation understands, just like any other missionary.
Do you think that some of the ministries out there, the apologetics ministries, creation ministries, the worldview ministries, have made an impact out there on the young people? Are they going to influence the Christian colleges and the churches?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. I there's so much more available now than when I was young.
Hmm.
I think it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to use it a whole lot more. I keep hearing from people who say, how can I get my pastor interested? You know, how can I bring this into my church? They still encounter some resistance. But I'm just amazed at how much material is available today. If I'd had this material available, I don't know that I would have taken that long route into agnosticism. You know, I would have been equipped at a much earlier age. I think it's making a difference. Of course, we can always do better. And I think where we're weakest is what you said in your earlier question, which is, most of the apologetics books are answering what I call insider questions. What is the Trinity? And how can Jesus be God? And what about suffering if God is good? Or what about hell? These are insider questions that young people within the church often have. We're not quite as good as answering the outsider questions, which is, well, what about materialism? What about existentialism? What about romanticism? All these isms, and especially the materialism and naturalism, which is dominant in the academic world. We're not quite as good at answering the outsider questions, and that's where we need to get stronger. And so that's really where I focus in finding truth, is on answering the secular worldviews and equipping young people with a strategy that they can use.
And what you try to do in the book is to point out the bankruptcy of humanist, Thomist ideas like existentialism and materialism and such. Well, give us a quick method as best as you can to address something like existentialism. How do you go at it?
Well, here's what I suggest. So from Romans 1, I pull out five principles. And in Romans 1, Paul says that anyone who does not acknowledge the biblical God will take something within creation and turn it into an idol. And when you think about that in terms of a worldview, what it means is if you don't acknowledge the biblical God and build a worldview on that basis, you have to start somewhere. You know, atheists like to say, a common meme on atheist websites is, atheism is not a belief. It's just lack of belief in God. Well, that's not true. You have to put something in God's place.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot think without some starting point. And if you don't, you've put God as your ultimate reality. You'll put something else, today, usually something like matter. Is matter part of the created order? Of course it is. And so materialism qualifies as an idol in the Romans 1 definition. Well, reason, can reason be an idol? Sure. So rationalism as a philosophy sets up human reason as the source and standard of all truth. In fact, Albert Einstein called himself a believing rationalist. And he understood it as a full-blown creed. So the first step is find the idol.
Mm-hmm.
Any worldview, you know, my students are confronting the world of ideas for the first time, and they get overwhelmed and they get lost in the details. And I tell them, find the idol. If you find the idol, what it puts in the place of God, that shapes everything else. And the second step is, once you've found the idol, you can be certain that every worldview will have a lower view of the human person. Because in finding truth, I focus mostly on evidence for God from human nature. So I'm looking at human nature in particular. If you exchange the glory of God for something in creation, you will exchange the image of God for something in creation.
Hmm.
So sticking with materialism, if you put matter in the place of God, you will redefine human beings as nothing but complex biochemical machines.
Yeah.
You will have a lower, inhumane, dehumanizing view of the human person. Once you figure out those two steps, you can test the worldview. That's the third step is, does it fit the real world? It will never fit the real world because its view of the human person is too low.
Hmm.
It's like trying to stick all of reality into a box. Something will always stick out of the box. It won't fit. There will always be some part of human nature that the secular worldview will not account for. And the second one is, the first test then is, does it fit the real world? The second test is, does it cohere internally? Is it logically consistent? And once again, you can be certain that it will not hold together logically. And the reason for that is, again, it has a low view of the human person. That always includes a low view of human cognitive abilities, the mind, rationality, reason. And yet, how do they support their own view? Well, they have to use reason. So when they undercut reason, they undercut their own view. It becomes self-refuting. Let me give you one or two examples. Marxism. Marxism is still really big on American college campuses. There was a French philosopher recently who said, nowadays when we want to debate a Marxist, we have to import one from an American university. So it's very big on campuses today. But what did Marx say? He said, you don't believe what you believe because you're rationally persuaded it's true, but because of your economic interest. Well, to be consistent, he has to apply that to his own theory. Did he come up with his own theory only to advance his economic interest? Well, in that case, why should the rest of us pay any attention to it? It's self-refuting. It shoots itself in the foot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or Sigmund Freud had a huge influence on the modern mind. He said, you don't believe what you believe because you're rationally persuaded it's true, but because of your psychological history, especially sexual repression. Well, to be consistent, he has to apply that standard to his own theory. Did he come up with it because of his own sexual repressions?
Mm-hmm.
You see, it shoots himself in the foot. So each non-Christian worldview comes up with a lower view of reason,
mm-hmm.
and therefore shoots itself in the foot, mm-hmm. is self-defeating, commits suicide.
Yeah.
Christianity doesn't have that problem because it says we're made in God's image. Our mind reflects the divine mind. So we have a high view of reason. So in a sense, every non-Christian worldview has to borrow a Christian view of reason in order to avoid being self-refuting.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, in just 3 minutes, Nancy Percy dropped an atom bomb on all the false worldviews, and that's all a synopsis of their new book called Finding Truth, and you can find that anywhere on the Internet. We're out of time, though, but Nancy Percy, once again, has given us a wonderful synopsis of an apologetic, how the Christians can stand in a world of ideas, of philosophers, of those that have raised up imaginations against the knowledge of God in Christ. And believe it or not, the knowledge of God in Christ, the revelation of God, stands the test and will continue to stand the test. And the reason, of course, is because we are thinking God's thoughts after Him, and God is really smart. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us again on Generations. We appreciate your work.
Well, thank you, and I like that last line. God is really smart.
I think that's our basic epistemological structure right there.
Good. I agree.
And you have been listening to the Generations Radio Broadcast. If you'd like to interact with the radio program, email me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.
Parental freedom, medical freedoms, religious freedoms, substantial freedoms. Are they going away?
Will America look like North Korea, Sweden, or Canada anytime soon? What is happening to religious freedoms in America? Folks, this is the issue as American Christians approach the 2016 elections. That's why the Freedom 2015 conference in Des Moines, November 6th and 7th. You won't want to miss the speakers, the challenge, the equipping, the celebration of liberty, the presidential forum, and the presidential straw poll. Your family, your church's future, hangs on this. Register now at freedom2015.org. That's freedom2015.org.